Well, good morning, and welcome to the first meeting of the PCAOB's Investor Advisory Group. I want to thank all of you for participating and agreeing to donate your time, expertise, and commitment to this advisory group. I particularly welcome SEC Commissioner Elise Walter. Commissioner Walter, your long-standing commitment to the protection of investors is well known, and your presence here means a great deal to us, as does your interest in the PCAOB. And Elise was telling me that her dad was an accountant and a CFO. So we welcome that background, your heredity, and at one point you indicated that you might want to have been an accountant, but you went into a different direction, and I think it was Harvard Law School and the lawyer. But in any event, we're delighted to have you and your interest. This group was formed to provide a public forum specifically for the board to obtain the views of and advice from the broad investor community on auditor oversight matters affecting investors. Too often, in my opinion, regulators hear, for the most part, from those they regulate and not enough from their other key stakeholders. Today, we are reaching out specifically to representatives of the investor community. As such, we seek your direct input and want to hear your views and specific recommendations for the priorities of the PCAOB. Our mandate, as spelled out in the very first sentence of Title I of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002, is to, quote, to oversee the audit of public companies that are subject to the securities laws and related matters in order to protect the interest of investors and further the public interest in the preparation of informative, accurate, and independent audit reports, close quote. In assigning the board this mandate, Congress recognized that high-quality independent auditors are vital for maintaining the transparency and investor trust in reported financial information that enables our markets to function effectively. We look forward to your input on ways to improve our programs and how best to accomplish our mandate to protect and serve the interests of investors. All of the board members and senior staff of the PCAOB are here today because we recognize how much we can benefit from your expertise and experience. Turning to the format for today's meeting, as you know, we solicited input from all of you as to your top four or five priorities for the PCAOB to consider, and you provided us with lists of important and far-ranging topics. We have taken your recommendations and structured them into broad categories, and I particularly want to thank Joanne Heineman for her efforts in both the substantive and administrative organization of this meeting and the spreadsheet that you have in front of you. Each of you should have received a spreadsheet summarizing the recommendations and should have a copy in front of you together with a folder including a variety of information for about today's meeting. We have tried to structure our meeting around these broad topics with the objective of providing every member with an opportunity to discuss his or her top priority. More specifically, the topics will be presented today as part of five panel discussions as follows. First, we will have a discussion on lessons learned from the financial crisis and the establishment of a fraud center. Initiating discussion will be Brandon Becker and Mike Head. Next, we will discuss foreign inspections with Joe Crisella and Ann Yerger leading those discussions. After lunch, we will talk about greater transparency and governance of audit firms with Pete Noctway, Ann Simpson, and Lynn Turner during the introductions. And Lynn, I want to thank you personally for being here. I know that you were invited to testify this morning, you know, on the Hill in front of Senator Specter at the Judiciary Committee. So we appreciate your presence. I know that Barbara Roper and Damon Silvers did accept that invitation, and they will be here later. Then we will focus on greater transparency of the audit process with Kelvin Blake, Norman Harrison, and Bonnie Hill. And the last panel discussion will be on auditor expertise and responsibilities with Tony Sondi, Judge Stanley Sporkin, and Bob Tirola. After a very brief introduction of the panel by one of the PCOB board members, each panel will initiate and discuss their topic and then lead the other group members in a discussion of the topic. At the end of the day, there will be a sixth session reserved for an open discussion on any topics not adequately addressed by the panel discussions. In short, we have structured this meeting in order to provide an opportunity for an open discussion by the group so that we can hear your views and priorities for the PCAOB. Throughout today's meeting, I would ask that each of you keep in mind and seek to answer the question, how do we make audits more relevant to investors? I would also note that today's meeting is being webcast. Since we would like the open discussions to be informal and free-flowing, please do not feel as though you have to be recognized to speak. We would ask, however, that for the benefit of those listening to the webcast, you identify yourself the first time you speak and periodically throughout the day. This meeting is open to the public, and the group members' written statements that we received have been posted on our website. Now, before getting started, let me recognize our acting chairman, Dan Geltzer, then SEC Commissioner Walter, and our board members, Bill Gratison and Charlie Niemeyer, and open up the floor to them for any opening remarks that they would like to make.
Thank you very much, Steve. I'd just like to join you in welcoming everyone to this inaugural meeting of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board's Investor Advisory Group. As Steve has noted, the board's mission is investor protection. Our job is to further the interests of investors in reliable audited financial reporting. Despite that fact, understanding what investors want and need, I think, has proven to be somewhat of a challenge for us. We certainly hear frequently from individual auditors, from accounting firms, from preparers, and naturally so, because our work directly affects them. But I think we have less input from investors, and this group has been created in order to try and change that state of affairs. Under Steve's leadership, as he's already outlined, we've put together a very, I think, ambitious and wide-ranging agenda of topics today, and I'm certainly looking forward to hearing everyone's views on what we ought to be doing to address these issues that confront us. I'd just add that I think this advisory group's been created at an especially appropriate moment in the life of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board. We've been in operation about 7 years now. It's hard for me to believe that 7 years have passed. In that time, much of what we've done has been devoted to taking the blueprint that the Sarbanes-Oxley Act laid out and making it into a functioning, active set of programs. And indeed, we do have an inspection program, standard-setting program, enforcement program, risk assessment effort, all of which, if not fully mature, are at least robust adolescents at this point. So I think it's a good time now for us maybe to step back a bit and ask ourselves what challenges have emerged along the way and what we ought to be doing better or differently in order to accomplish our mission. I certainly see this meeting today as part of that kind of assessment process. As Steve has noted, we're very fortunate to have one of the SEC commissioners here with us today, Elise Walter. This is particularly a treat for me because Elise and I go way back. We worked together on the staff of the SEC in the 70s and 80s. It's okay to say that, isn't it, Elise? I hope. Elise then went on to also serve at the CFTC and to work at FINRA, so I think she has a kind of a unique background for the sort of issues that we're going to discuss here today. She certainly has a well-known and long-standing reputation as an investor advocate. I'm glad that she's willing to devote her time to us here today. Elise, let me ask if you have any comments you'd like to make at the beginning.
Thank you, Dan, and I want to thank Steve as well for his very kind words. Whether it's because of heredity or because of my years with Dan or because of my years in the Division of Corporation Finance at the Commission, I think accounting is somewhat in my blood, and I do think that auditors are particularly important to the proper working of our investor protection and capital formation systems. They really are critical gatekeepers. And what the PCAOB does, and it was a long time in coming, but it's good to have it here, is so critical to the Commission's overall mission and being successful in carrying it out. We share with you the challenges of effectively receiving investor voices, and in large part through the efforts of some of the people in this room who I know well. I think we're getting better at it, but we're not all the way there. So I, too, want to congratulate Steve for spearheading, setting up this group, and I look forward to what I get to hear today and becoming more educated. I do find that perhaps the greatest concentration of my time as a commissioner has been in the accounting and auditing area, so I confess to already spending a lot of time with accountants, and I'd actually like to spend a bit more, so I stand ready to be educated this morning and to add any value that I can. Thank you for having me here.
Thank you. Bill?
Thank you, Dan. I want to add my word of thanks to Steve for taking the lead in recommending that this group be created and inducing so many of you who bring so much knowledge to the table to join us here today and in the future. My own background actually was working directly with investors as a general partner of a small New York Stock Exchange firm in my hometown of Cincinnati for years, and we were mostly dealing with individuals and small businesses, small pension funds and profit-sharing funds, charities and things of that kind. Of course, the world has changed enormously since that time. Investors are far more involved in working through institutions, and that's been a very dramatic change. Many of you, perhaps all of you, bring to bear experiences that go way beyond the things that I learned when I was out in the field years ago, and I look forward to learning from you in the course of not only this session, but others in the future.
Charlie?
Well, certainly this is a very important event for us. I think Dan put it well that we're at a pivotal point in the evolution of the PCAOB and where we fit into the system. We have, I believe, a good foundation. But it is time to really take a look at what we've done, to take a look at what we need to do to improve. And from where I sit, there's still a lot of room for improvement. So we're very interested in hearing what you have to say and what we can do to make these things reality. Thank you.
And now before we actually get started, if we could go around the room and everybody very briefly introduce themselves. Judge, I'm not sure you need an introduction, but why don't you start?
Robert Tirola, good morning.
Well, you can actually identify yourself a little bit more than that. I think the judge was headed up the Division of Enforcement, was at the CIA, and was at Weill Gotshal, so you can make it just a little bit broader than that. I know the time is pressed, but Bob,
I'll expand a little bit more if you care to. My current involvement from an investor perspective is I serve on the board of directors of 15 mutual funds sponsored by Legg Mason and an operating company listed on NASDAQ based in Denver. My experience is about a dozen years as a public company CFO, a dozen years as a public company auditor, and currently serve on two audit committees.
Okay, how's that? Do I need to start all over, or am I okay? Bonnie Hill, and I think I've said enough.
I'm Tony Sonley. I run a financial consulting and advisory firm. I'm also a member of the Emerging Issues Task Force of the FASB, and I've been involved in standard setting as a financial analyst and as a user of financial statements for a little more than 9 years in a direct form. I've also written books on financial analysis and on various accounting issues that fortunately for me are widely used. Thank you.
Norman Harrison with Breeden Capital Partners. My firm is headed by Richard Breeden, a former chairman of the SEC. We invest in public companies with a view toward increasing value for shareholders by focusing on improvements in governance and the manner in which improved governance translates into improved strategy and operations and as a device to create value for shareholders. I'm a lawyer and investment banker by training, not an accountant, so I'm a bit humbled by the company in which I sit, but I'm very, very glad to be a part of the group.
My name is Kelvin Blake. I'm a lawyer for the Division of Securities for the State of Maryland, which is a part of the Attorney General's Office. I work in the Investment Advisor Broker-Dealer Unit.
I'm Gus Sauter. I'm the Chief Investment Officer of Vanguard Mutual Funds. We have over 150 mutual funds investing more than $1 trillion in public companies, so we're very interested in gaining more information and being able to better analyze financial statements.
I'm Meredith Williams. I work for about 460,000 of the very best people in the state of Colorado, running the public pension plan called PERA. Thank you.
I'm Ann Simpson, and improbable though it sounds, I work for CalPERS. I'm the senior portfolio manager, and I'm responsible for the governance program there. However, I think Steve originally invited me to join this group because of my international background. Prior to that, I worked for the International Corporate Governance Network, which represents investors in some 40-odd countries. And before that, I headed the World Bank's governance programs in the wake of the Asia crisis. Some very familiar debates then about auditing and accounting. And before that, I was managing director of an investment firm in London for many years.
Pete Nakwe, I'm the CFO for Carlyle. That's my primary day job, although I've been chief cook and bottle washer with everything that goes on in our firm. Prior to joining Carlyle 3 years ago, I was a partner at Deloitte & Touche, where I was employed there for about 27 years, and the last job I had there was heading up the investment management practice in the Northeast.
Lynn Turner, I serve on the board of a mutual fund complex and also serve those 460,000 people in Colorado as the trustee of CoPERA.
I'm Ann Yerger with the Council of Institutional Investors. That's an association of public, corporate, and union employee benefit plans with about $3 trillion in assets. They have a very significant commitment to our U.S. markets, investing about 60% of their portfolios in just stocks and bonds of public companies here, and they obviously have a deep interest in the quality of the financial statements that are provided to them.
I'm Joe Carcello. I'm an accounting professor at the University of Tennessee and co-founder and director of research of our Corporate Governance Center. Done a lot of research on fraud, public company fraud, including a study that will be coming out by COSO shortly based on SEC enforcement actions, a lot of work on audit committees. I chair the audit committee of a governmental entity and had the privilege of serving on the PCAOB SAG for the previous 4 years.
My name is Michael Head, and I'm managing director of corporate audit for TD Ameritrade. About 30 years of combination public and private audit experience. Serve on the board of the Institute of Internal Auditors, the global body that oversees internal auditing around the world, and actually serve as the chair of their audit committee. Hope to bring some of the perspective of how internal and external audit work together, and in particular in the brokerage industry, and how we can advise and help the PCAOB strengthen some of how that audit approach can be considered going forward with some of their oversight.
Brandon Becker, Executive Vice President and Chief Legal Officer of TIA CREF, one of the largest private pension managers. We have 3.7 million participants. Prior to that, I was a partner in WilmerHale, responsible for its broker-dealer program. And prior to that, I was director of the Division of Market Regulation at the SEC.
Thank you very much. Before we get to our first discussion, I want to point out that in your folder, you should find a copy of the PCAOB's ethics policy. We ask that you please read the policy and provide us with a signed copy before you leave today. Now turning to our first topic, lessons learned from the financial crisis and the establishment of a fraud center. This topic was mentioned by a number of you as a top priority for the PCAOB to consider. Brandon Becker, you suggested that we should, quote, review the PCAOB and audit firm's performance leading up to the financial crisis. More specifically, you asked, how did audit firms measure risk, and did auditors have the necessary level of expertise? Mike Head, you brought it up in the context of broker-dealers. And those of you who have listed these issues as very high on your priority lists include Joe Carcello, Barbara Roper, Ann Simpson, Lynn Turner, Meredith Williams, and Ann Yerger. Some of you tied the concept of reviewing lessons learned from the financial crisis to the recommendations by the Treasury's Advisory Committee on the auditing profession that the PCAOB establish a fraud center. As you know, last month, we announced that we were seeking to fill a newly created position of director of the Financial Reporting Fraud Resource Center, which is being established in response to the Treasury Advisory Committee recommendation. So it is very timely that we hear your thoughts on these topics, particularly given the level of interest expressed by the IAG members, as well as recent events in the news. For example, just last week, the Financial Times reported that the European Commission is planning to scrutinize the role played by auditors, adding to a growing international focus on the profession in the aftermath of the financial crisis, which could lead to tighter supervision. Brandon, I would ask that you and Mike kick off the conversation on this first topic, and then we'll open up to all the members.
Thank you, Steve. At the risk of breaking your flow and taking a little editorial license, let me just add before turning to that topic how much all members of the Investor Advisory Group appreciate the board's willingness to make itself available to listen to our views, and in particular how much we appreciate the efforts that you made, Steve, as well as your staff, Joanne O'Rourke Hinman, to make this a successful advisory group and a seamless process. We very much appreciate your and the board's efforts and willingness to participate in this process, as well as those of the Securities and Exchange Commission. So our many thanks to you and the board. Turning to the topic of the panel, Steve has nicely recapitulated the overall arching theme. I think that I'll just try and put it in a little context before I turn it over to Mike to talk about some of the particular areas with respect to financial services. As the participants know, at least since Professor Andrew Lowe of MIT began his efforts to stimulate interest in a so-called Capital Market Safety Board, modeled after the CAB, there's been an active dialogue about whether there is some method short of enforcement where you could go back diagnostically and try and look at what's happened over the last couple of years with a view toward identifying problem areas and potential solutions or at least best practices on a going forward basis. One of the criticisms, or at least practical limitations on that, that has been highlighted by some commentators is that the issue is too broad. The problem was global. The markets involved were of such scope that the idea that one could actually go back and look at this particular event in the same way that, for example, the SEC special study looked at the 1962 market break, or comparable, more textured reviews, is just not within the realm of the doable, at least not within our lives and being. I think that is a little bit too stark of a definition of the issue, because if you look at the way in which various of our colleagues' papers talk about a fraud center, there can be a more targeted assessment. Steve has already mentioned, and the SEC has already begun its own assessment of how we were dealing with 105 transactions, so that you can, I think, if not aspire to a global encyclopedia of the crash, notwithstanding the fact that we seem to get a new book every week on the bubble and its consequences, one could envision looking at targeted practices and asking yourself whether, when we look back at those practices, there's something we can do going forward. Now, at its heart, I think that instinct
is to take a step beyond the it was an act of God, it was unforeseeable, received wisdom, said that no one could know how this was going to happen. Actually, as it has developed over time, there were voices, there were critics, there were people pointing out potential risks. They were just not in the majority view or the consensus view. So part of, I think, what we want to ask ourselves is why weren't those voices heard? What can we do to incorporate those voices going forward? And where can we identify failures in our practices? Some of the areas that at least have captured our attention and are described in more detail in my written testimony are how do we assess quality of earnings? How do we go back and look at unrealized gains and losses? How do we assess earnings based on models and estimates when we haven't been through the entire earnings cycle of a financial instrument? What can we do about tail risk going forward? It seems obvious that we're not going to eliminate the reliance upon modeling and trying to give estimates of quality of earnings, but at some point we should be able to get smarter in trying to deal with the kinkiness of tail risk and some of the problems in trying to rely upon that within any particular financial reporting period. And that's just another example. So whether it's repos or tail risk or other valuation issues, it strikes us that one could go back and try and look on a horizontal basis and assess whether we did the job correctly and how we can do it better. And in doing that, I think one of the instincts, the common sense instincts here, I would argue, is that if we can do that outside of the enforcement context is critical in terms of accountability, it's critical in terms of developing data and subpoena power and the like, but sometimes it doesn't give you the broad horizontal assessment of how you want an industry to be governed going forward. And to try and pull together a diverse set of resources to assess that, both economists and traders, lawyers and accountants, forensics and diagnostics, we think could provide valuable lessons for the industry as we confront what will undoubtedly be recurring issues as we come out of the current situation. So with that pitch, why don't you let me turn it over to Mike to talk about some of the particulars in the financial services industry.
Thank you, Brandon. And due to, you know, my background, I'll be fairly focused on broker-dealer and registered broker-dealers in that environment. And probably, you know, one of the obvious things to analyze and see if there's lessons learned can tie into situations like the Madoff. And the energy that myself, my company, and our industry probably were looking at that and trying to assess, were there some things that could have been done to either avoid that, minimize it, or identify it and address it in a more timely manner before some of the damages that took place did take place. As an internal audit professional, a long-term investor advocate, I'm very pleased that the PCAOB has made this very timely decision to focus on investor protection. I'm also pleased that the PCAOB is interested in considering ways it can target their efforts to increase investor confidence in the auditing financial information and auditors' reports and make that information and reports more useful to the individual investors. To that end, I offer some of the following thoughts on strategic direction and future emphasis that the PCAOB, through the Investor Advisory Group advocates efforts, could address in lessons learned. One of the primary things that I think we need to look at is not only the fraud center and analyzing and looking back, but are there some systemic opportunities here? As an auditor, we focus on processes. We focus on trying to get consistency in processes and then addressing exceptions or things that seem to be out of that norm. And to that end, I think there's three, four, or five things that the PCAOB should advocate and, where possible, require some consistent audit requirements for registered broker-dealers, both on the introducing broker-dealer side and the clearing and custodial broker-dealer side. Some of those could include in addition to requiring independent auditing firms of broker-dealers to register with the PCAOB, the audit firm should also be subject to inspection by the PCAOB. The retail advisor does not realize today that being registered with the PCAOB does not bring with it any true oversight by the PCAOB if it's not part of a publicly audited situation. Once the broker-dealer registered auditing firms are subject to inspection and oversight by the PCAOB, clearing broker-dealer organizations should be subject to the Sarbanes-Oxley Section 404 or similar requirements for compliance. There's been a lot of debate about has that achieved the objective that was intended, but I think if we're all really honest with ourselves, that it has brought the needed and appropriate attention to the internal controls over financial reporting and disclosure that was lacking prior to that, and that's still absent in the registered brokerage environment. It's gotten there through banking and through some others, but if you're a pure introducing or custodial broker-dealer and not publicly traded, you aren't subject to similar audit requirements nor management certifying their internal controls. And that discipline, I think, is a key element in improving the financial services broker-dealer environment. As a result, those auditing firms would be subject to auditing standard number 5. And I think that's critical, too, where, again, today, if you're not in a publicly traded broker-dealer situation, those auditing firms are not necessarily subject to auditing standard 5. Now, we would assume those firms, through their firm practices, would employ similar, but it's not required from oversight from a PCAOB point of view. These measures would enhance investor protection and the quality of the financial reporting available to and relied upon by the retail investor. And they don't understand. If you ask them, they would assume there's not any difference in an audited opinion they get on a non-public registered broker-dealer and a publicly traded registered broker-dealer. Once the broker-dealer registered auditing firms are subject to inspection and oversight by the PCAOB. Custodial broker-dealers in particular, I think, should be subject and required to have SAS 70 Type 2 service organization audits performed of their custodial controls. Currently, only affiliated custodial broker-dealers are required to comply with the SEC custody rule, the 2064-2, and are subject to this SAS 70 Type 2 audits under the recently revised SEC custody rules. Requiring a custodial control SAS 70 Type audit of all clearing broker-dealers, no matter if it's affiliated or not, would help enhance investor protection and the quality of the financial reporting. In both of the SOX 404 compliance and custodial controls related to a custodial or clearing broker-dealer, these are much more focused on not just internal controls over financial reporting, but all of the operating controls that support the processing of transactions and compliance with laws and regulations that ultimately the scorekeeping and the financial statements rely upon. But again, the retail investor assumes their assets are safe and they exist. And obviously, from what we saw with the Madoff situation, that may or may not be true, and we don't have the safety nets in place to allow for some oversight auditing and review by both internal auditors and external auditors to help ensure that with those retail investors that those assets exist, they're safeguarded, and the controls to protect them are in place. And I think the SOX 404 and the SAS 70 Type 2 are two just blocking and tackling table stakes that should be there for all registered broker-dealers. I also think we have an opportunity and was somewhat disappointed when AS5 came out to replace AS2, that in AS2 there was mention of the internal auditing global standards, and that went away in AS5. Now, just being recognized for the sake of being recognized is not what's important. What I think it emphasized there was the importance of consistency between companies and firms' internal audit functions, that they should be there and that there should be consistency so that people, regulators, shareholders, investors, and external auditors know when certain internal audit practices are in place. If they're adhering to standards, they have more reliance that it's consistent, that it's the same from one company to the next. And by acknowledging those standards and setting an expectation that when there's an internal audit function in place that is functioning at what's considered an adequate level, that they know what that means, that there's definitions in the standards that people can go to, retail investors and others, to tie to that. Finally, when we have internal audit functions that are comprehensive and can be relied upon, there is a lot of benefit for synergies and efficiencies, both for the regulators and external auditors, to review that work, place some reliance on it. But the standard that presently exists that kind of guides when and how you can do that, this current SAS 65, is quite dated, is over 20 years old, and does not and could not at that time consider the roles and responsibilities that internal auditors, professionals, currently take on. There's a unique timing and opportunity here with the IFAC and the convergence and consolidation and the gap in international standards, to not miss this opportunity that currently IFAC is currently revising ISA 610 use of work of internal auditors, and this is a perfect opportunity from PCAOB and from an auditing standards point of view to consider either revising or replacing SAS 65 and working with IFAC. The Institute of Internal Auditors is currently partnering with IFAC to revise 610 and would love the opportunity to work with the PCAOB to either revise or develop a new standard that would be similar and fit in with the goals going forward that are consistent global standards. Those are some of my initial thoughts. I know they're fairly tailored directly to broker dealers and not as broadly to the financial services industry, but I think there was a lot of the problems we encountered similar to the Madoff situation were some of these basic, once we looked at the hindsight situation, maybe couldn't have been totally prevented, but maybe could have mitigated or minimized some of the damage that was done if we would have had some of these things in place. And with that, I would open it up.
Well, Mike, thank you and Brandon very much. And I know that in terms of these two topics, a number of members put them very high on their priority list. And so in terms of lessons learned, I know that Ann Simpson and others have put that on a priority. But I know that on the Fraud Center, Ann Yerger, you had mentioned that as a very high priority. Maybe we'll start with you. But I know that Meredith Williams and Lynn Turner and Joe Carcello have also mentioned the Fraud Center as a very high priority, because that is an issue that the PCAOB is addressing. We welcome your comments on that, because I guess for lack of a better word, I view the Fraud Center as low-hanging fruit that maybe we can all agree upon in terms of what ought to be done. So I don't know, Ann Simpson, whether you want to start with the lessons learned, or Ann Yerger, you want to start with the Fraud Center. Dan?
Well, this is Ann Yerger, and I'm sort of right now representing also Damon Silvers, who called me yesterday sending his regrets. He couldn't be here and looks forward to joining us after he's on the Hill, and the sum total of what he told me to say fits on this note card. So I'm confident that his presentation would be far more expansive and articulate than what I'm going to share, but largely we're on the same page. And I think that Damon and my thoughts are that we were so supportive of the establishment of the PCAOB, and I think it was instrumental in helping restore public trust in the auditing profession and the quality of audited financials. But obviously fraud continues. Madoff is a perfect example, and there's no stopping ever fraud, I don't think, because there are always people who are going to try to break the laws or play fast and loose with the rules. But that there's an opportunity here to learn from problems, and as a result, we feel very strongly that the establishment of this National Fraud Center is absolutely critical. Damon and I and Lynn served on the Treasury Department's Advisory Commission on the Auditing Profession, and one of the core recommendations was that we believe the PCAOB should establish this fraud center. Just as background, there was a lot of debate about who should own this center. And the fact is that some folks wanted it to be housed with the profession, and I think that the majority of members, at least of the ACAP, believed very strongly that the appropriate place for this was with the PCAOB. You're an independent body, and we felt that the establishment of this entity could ultimately really assist the board in doing its work in terms of standard setting. Clearly, not only are there concerns about fraud, but I think the public, rightly so, has been concerned about the quality of, in some cases, it's been accounting standards, which I understand is not the purview of the PCAOB, but certainly auditing standards and professional conduct surrounding things varying from fair value accounting for financial statements or instruments, excuse me, off-balance sheet vehicles, repo 105s. And even loan loss reserves. And obviously right now we're centering a lot on financial entities because that has been where the most interest and I think concerns are centering. I think that the Fraud Center could play a really important role, not just addressing fraud, but addressing areas where there's the potential for fraud. So I think Damon and my message would be we encourage the board to make certain that the center is not simply a library for fraud, but it goes far beyond that. Damon recommended that the board consider applying some sort of safe harbor so that there's a comfort zone to share non-public information that may assist the board again in developing auditing standards and even in the FASB and ISB in terms of setting accounting standards. So with that, I'll stop. Happy to answer any questions, and Ann, I'll pass it to you.
Thank you. Ann Simpson, CalPERS. We didn't flag up the Fraud Center in particular as a priority because we felt that really the legacy of work or the unfinished business from ACAP is something that we hope the PCAOB will turn to. There's much there that's really important. We implored the group that worked on it, and we realise events have rather overtaken everyone, and it's time to return to that, and this is one piece of that work programme. I suppose our reflection is more that the banality of the run-up to the disaster is what troubles us, is the fact that everybody was seduced in the situation. And we know that boards of directors are reconsidering what went wrong. As investors, we're reconsidering what we weren't paying attention to. The credit rating agencies have been rightly the focus of attention for their role. But auditors have been relatively unexamined. And I'm struck, this is probably for me, speaking my age now, the third crisis discussion about what went wrong. Remember the days of Maxwell, Foreign and Colonial, a whole heap of British companies that collapsed following the issuing of clean audit reports. That gave rise to the now named Cadbury Code of Practice and sort of invented corporate governance for the UK anyway. Then we had the Asia crisis, the U.S. disasters around Enron and WorldCom, and now we are in the wake of the current disaster. So I suppose what we're puzzling on is how many things do we need to put right in order to really introduce safety and soundness into the system? And some of the things that are needed are quite ordinary, not extraordinary. We still are looking at some basic issues around transparency, as Anne said, about audit standards that do not capture relevant activity, that's very concerning, off-balance sheet activity being an obvious example. You know, concepts of internal controls that don't extend to all of the activities, that particularly in the financial sector, that were undertaken. Boards of directors who claim they did not understand what was going on. It's very troubling. If you had a dentist who didn't understand teeth, you'd pretty soon move on to another dentist. So, you know, this whole related discussion around majority voting, around proxy access, to hold boards accountable, I think that's very important. But also there are responsibilities for investors on what they're paying attention to as well, so we don't shirk our responsibility. So fraud is certainly the dramatic TV, CSI, end of this, but it's the ordinary, banal, routine activity of companies where we really want to tighten up the standards of old-fashioned transparency and accountability. So I really think this group's got an important job to do, to think in very practical terms. What is it we need to know? What is it we need to have reported? And what is it, you know, what is it that the job of the auditor needs to be in order to play that critical role? Because they really were the dogs that didn't bark. They weren't the only ones, but certainly we need to examine that.
Well, before, actually, hold on, Judge, for a sec. But before we get to responding to your comments and statements, I would like to stick with the Fraud Center for just, you know, another 5 or 10 minutes. And I know that, Meredith, you have some ideas on that. Lynn, you clearly have. And Joe, you have. And Bob Burns on our staff is taking the lead on that. And I think that the more you can input here, you know, we can help define the Fraud Center, and then we can broadly discuss the other issues. So why don't the three of you and anybody else comment on your views of the Fraud Center, and then Judge will recognize you. Meredith, you want to?
I'll start that out. I think the Fraud Center has great promise, but I think we need to be careful with expectations. I see it as a device that will do postmortems on what I'm going to call audit failures. Though auditors would probably argue that we're following the audit standards, and unless something shows up in our sample, in our confirmations, we're clean. Well, I think that requires an attitude adjustment. And I think by doing a series of postmortems, and hopefully using the safe harbor sort of approach that Ann suggests, they can be done on a relatively timely basis, so we don't have to wait for all the court cases to be cleared before we can sit down and say what went wrong, what might have been done different, how might we have alerted the investment public. And I think over time, by going through this exercise, I think that there will be a mindset change for auditors. And I think the so-called expectation gap between the investment community and the audit community might be significantly narrowed. But I don't think that just is going to be movement on the part of the investment community. I think there will have to be movement on the part of the audit community, too, and perhaps the PCAOB will have to take a good, strong look at the results that come out of the audits, the findings that come out of the Fraud Center, and perhaps there will be a need to redirect the audit effort to have more of a focus on fraud to serve the investment public. I think those are my comments. I think it's very important, but I think it's a long-term sort of effort. We're not going to turn around in the next 30, 60, 90 days. It's a long-term education effort.
Joe, Lynn?